from West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for the legislature today is provided by the following.
AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State. Online at aarp.org/WV. West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission, working to double the degrees produced annually to meet workforce demands and grow West Virginia's economy. Learn more at wvhepc.edu. The W. Page Pitt School of Journalism and Mass Communications at Marshall University, providing hands-on education in advertising, public relations, and journalism across all media platforms.
At the legislature today, the governor's legislative proposals are starting to make their way into both chambers. What members of the Senate think of his bills so far? In the House, delegates debate a bill cutting an agency that promotes women's issues. And there are a significant number of lawmakers under the age of 35 in the legislature this year. How the group is working to change the State House. Coming up on the legislature today. Good evening, I'm Ashton Mara. Governor Jim Justice will have a total of 29 bills for lawmakers to consider this session, and in the Senate at least, those bills are beginning to move through the process. Senators on both sides of the aisle say they have an interest in several of the governor's proposals this session, including a precautionary measure that could be needed if the state's revenues continue to decline. Republican leaders of the West Virginia Senate have made their thoughts on the governor's budget plan clear. They do not agree with his proposal to increase taxes to generate $450 million in new revenue. But their opposition to his budget plan doesn't necessarily carry over into all of Governor Jim Justice's legislative proposals. Several of those are receiving bipartisan support in the chamber. That includes a bill that hasn't been introduced in the Senate just yet, but that the governor urged lawmakers to approve in a written statement Thursday. It's a bill that would allow the governor to furlough state workers, or essentially make them take days off without pay, to curb the state's costs. Bob Ashley is the governor's legislative director.
It's a bill that he feels he needs as a tool in his toolbox because of the revenue problems that we're having.
Between July and January, state tax collections came in at about $120 million below estimates. To close that gap, Governor Justice is asking lawmakers to pull money from the state's rainy day fund. Ashley says furloughs would be a way to help save dollars in the short term. But Senate President Mitch Carmichael says the governor may be sending another message by presenting the bill this early in the session.
It's almost like sort of a tactic to determine that, hey, this legislature may not be able to work out the budget.
Carmichael says that's not going to happen. His party will complete a budget. Former Governor Earl Ray Tomlin presented lawmakers with a similar proposal during a special budget session last year that lasted well into June. Senate Minority Leader Roman Prezioso says with the length of time it took to complete the spending document last year, it might not be a bad idea to have a furlough law in place.
In the event that we come to a budget impasse, he's got to have an option to curtail some of the money that the state spends in to avert total collapse.
Despite his concerns about the message it may send, Carmichael says he supports the bill and it will likely progress through his chamber. Carmichael is also lending his support to the governor's comprehensive piece of education legislation that was introduced in the Senate this week. The lengthy bill contains several policy changes. It gets rid of the state's 8 regional education service agencies, or RESAs, makes it more difficult for the state to take over a county school system, ends the A through F grading system for schools, and increases teacher pay by 2%, among many other things. Legislative Director Ashley says the bill is about pushing control out of Charleston back to the local level.
Over the years, the legislature has put a lot of rules and regulations in code that tie the hands of what can happen. So the governor has put out a pretty big bill that will lessen the bureaucracy from the state level.
Carmichael says he hasn't gotten to work through the details of the bill just yet, but the overarching idea is one Republican lawmakers have been pushing for years.
The flexibility to the teachers and to the administrators to deliver a world-class education to our students. That's what his initiative in broad terms does. We support that, and we'll reserve right to comment on the details, but I'm very anxious to work with him to achieve that goal of returning control to the local entities.
Carmichael does not believe the bill will make it through the legislative process without some changes, though, like the teacher pay raise. The Senate president says he fully supports increasing teacher salaries, but says this isn't the year to do it.
I understand the motivation for providing additional and enhancements to the pay. We definitely want to get there. I really, frankly, think we should give pay raises in a year when we have money, not in a year in which we're facing tremendous deficits.
Ashley says most of the governor's legislative proposals focus on streamlining government, and he believes both Republican and Democratic lawmakers can support them.
He wants to get a handle on this state and get West Virginia out of the 50th spot that they're in. He wants to get us moving up. He says we're better than 50th, although we've not been managed like it. And his goal is to move us forward.
Senate Bill 420, the governor's comprehensive education reform bill, will make its way through the chamber's education and finance committees. All of the governor's legislative proposals are also being presented to members of the House.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Delegates are beginning to consider bills that would cut some state agencies, no matter how big or how small their budgets are. Today, members of one committee looked at a bill that would put an end to an agency that receives about $150,000 in annual funding. Liz McCormick joins us with more.
House Bill 2646 would get rid of the West Virginia Women's Commission. It's a small state agency with just two employees, one of whom works part-time. The House Government Organization Committee considered the bill this morning, where its sponsors defended the proposal. The West Virginia Women's Commission was created by the state legislature in 1977. It's a bipartisan organization under the State Department of Health and Human Resources with a mission to promote women through advocacy, research, and education. Over the past few years, one of the commission's main focuses has been to encourage women to run for legislative office, boards, or commissions through recruiting and training events. Chair of the Women's Commission, Stacey North, says she feels if the agency is shut down, it would be detrimental to West Virginia.
Image-wise, I think it'd be horrible. I mean, it's neglecting a huge segment of the population. It's making it look like we don't care. That would be a horrific move.
The House Government Organization Committee discussed the bill at length this morning. Vice Chair Delegate Lynn Arvon of Raleigh County noted the commission has done good things for some women, but she feels the group's mission is one that can be found through other organizations.
I see a lot of overlapping responsibility here, and to me, what we're trying to do this year, particularly with the budget we have, even though their budget's between $150,000 and $200,000 each year, some people think that's just a drop in the bucket. Maybe, but every drop in the bucket adds up. And I'm looking at ways we can start eliminating duplicative services. I don't believe the Women's Commission should be a government-funded commission.
That didn't seem to satisfy the minority party in committee, however. Democratic members of the committee disagreed with Arvon, including Delegate Mike Caputo of Marion County.
They're the go-to group for women to hopefully find avenues to get where they need to be. And more importantly, they're a nonpartisan group. This group has been very clear about their nonpartisanship and what they do for the state of West Virginia. But I find it very odd the bill was partisan. Every sponsor on the bill is from the majority party. So we're not seeing any bipartisan effort here in whether this is a good idea or not.
The House bill has a total of eight sponsors, all of whom are Republican women. Even so, Democratic Delegate Michael Farrow of Marshall County says he worries about the public's perception of the action.
I think the biggest thing here is that perception is reality. In the eyes of the general public, it is going to look like, as my colleague from Marion said, that 23 men are taking a personal affront against women. That might not be the case. That might not be the intent. of the sponsors, but I guarantee that that's the perception that's going to be out there.
The bill's lead sponsor, Delegate Kayla Kessinger of Fayette County, says the commission is unnecessary, and she says the work the commission does, particularly around election recruitment, is something women in the state are capable of doing on their own.
I think that every woman that is currently serving and has served in West Virginia has one based on her merits, her character, and voters' ability and voters' willingness to believe in them.
Kessinger says she understands the concerns, but she still fully believes in the proposal.
But the fact of the matter is, women are completely capable of becoming significant and achieving their dreams and goals on their own without government assistance. And I think that is what truly empowers women, is the ability to accomplish their dreams, their goals, without relying on the government.
Delegate Barbara Evans Fleshour is one of just two Democratic women in the House of Delegates. She opposes the bill.
Women in West Virginia are not doing as well in comparison to the rest of the country or in comparison to the world. I mean, United States women lag behind when it comes to the number of women in elected office, that it comes to women on corporate boards, that it comes to women graduates. I mean, we're far behind many countries when it comes to graduation from college, and we need to do better.
House Bill 2646 was voted out of the committee and will be sent to the full chamber for a vote that's likely to come next week.
Female representation in the West Virginia legislature is at its lowest rate since 1984. After the 2016 election, just 18 members of the House of Delegates and Senate are women.
We go to Cabell County tonight, where we meet three more members of the West Virginia legislature in this edition of Meet Your Lawmakers.
Sean Hornbuckle was first elected to the House of Delegates in 2014 and won re-election in 2016. He is a Democrat representing the House's 16th district. Hornbuckle is from Cabell County and a graduate of Marshall University, where he served as the student body president in 2009. Carol Miller also represents the 16th House of Delegates district. She is a Republican from Cabell County. Delegate Miller was elected in 2006. She serves as the majority whip. C.E. Chuck Romine is a Republican from Cabell County. He was elected in 2016 to represent the state's 16th House of Delegates district. Delegate Romine served in the House from 1968 to 1974 and another term in 1998. He is a retired insurance salesman and spent 42 years in the industry.
There are more than 30 new faces in the West Virginia House of Delegates this year, and more than a few of them fit into the nation's largest generation. Millennials are growing in number at the Capitol, and they are pushing their more senior counterparts to think a little differently. Samantha Godby reports.
Millennials, people ages 18 to 34, make up about 25% of the country's population. But the National Conference of State Legislatures reports the age group only makes up about 5% of the representatives in state legislatures. At the age of 20, Delegate Josh Higginbotham is one of the youngest members of West Virginia's legislature, where he says things are starting to change.
All the young people in this chamber, each and every one of us, are passionate about what we do and love helping people. And that's why we kept getting elected and why we continue to grow and strengthen our numbers here in Charleston.
During the 2016 election, West Virginia saw a drastic increase in its millennial representation. Now, 13% of the state's legislative body is made up of members of the young age group. Many of these legislators say they jumped into public service to share fresh ideas and fresh perspectives that range in terms of policy, from water innovation to broadband internet expansion to job creation. But according to 20-year-old Delegate Sarah Blair, what they have in common is a desire to see party lines dissolve to create a better West Virginia.
We've watched so much gridlock and hatred coming out of Washington, D.C., that we just don't want any part of that. And we automatically associate it with liberal or conservative, when we really are a lot of us. I think most people in the millennials and those below us are moderate.
A caucus of millennial legislators has been developing in these beginning weeks of session. 31-year-old delegate Sean Hornbuckle is one of the members heading up the group. And he says the goal is to promote those bipartisan ideas.
And it's going to be completely nonpartisan issues, more of almost a think tank. And how do we, A, push the state forward, but B, how do we make sure, whether in government or just involved in your communities, how do we get more younger folks to the table in helping to aid in that effort?
So what has caused the spike in millennial representation in West Virginia? Some suggest it's the frustration over political polarization. Some say it's the recent presidential election. But each of these young legislators mentioned something else that's driving them, something much more personal.
We care, and we're seeing our friends leave this state. My childhood best friends, they're both gone.
It's no mystery in West Virginia that we lead the country in exodus with people leaving.
We see a lot of influx of kids leaving. I've graduated kids from college, high school that have left the state.
24-year-old delegate Zach Maynard says lawmakers should be focused on finding ways to keep young West Virginians, like himself, in the state. And he and his fellow millennial legislators are equipped to do just that.
If we can't build a base or around, you know, what our kids want or, you know, moving this state forward, we're going to lose a generation.
Of the 17 millennial lawmakers in the House of Delegates this year, 9 are first-term members and 8 are returning. In the Senate, Majority Leader Ryan Ferns is the only millennial member. For the legislature today, I'm Samantha Godby at the State House.
This session has posed some unique challenges for lawmakers. In terms of the budget, they're dealing with one of the largest revenue gaps the state has ever seen. But in terms of personality, they're also dealing with a certainly unique and outspoken governor who's fairly new to government and the legislative process. Joining me tonight to discuss the latest in this legislative session is Dr. Rob Rupp. He's a political science professor at West Virginia Wesleyan College, and to his left is Dr. Mary Beth Beller, a professor from Marshall University. Thank you both for being here this evening.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Rupp, let's start with you. This is certainly an interesting legislative session we've got here, a new Democratic governor, and, you know, still fairly new leadership over in the Republican legislature.
Right, and not only that, but Ashton, this is the first time in the state's history that we've had a Democratic governor and a GOP-controlled House and Senate. In 1918, there was a Democratic governor and a Republican state Senate. Now we have a Democratic governor, and both houses are on the opposition. And this isn't standard operating procedure. And as you mentioned, we not only have a relatively inexperienced governor, but as you said, there's a large turnover in the House,
right,
too. So in a sense, this is a time for newbies.
Mm-hmm. It's true. No, Governor Tomlin, I think, was the first Democratic governor in a very long time to deal with a Republican-controlled legislature. What's interesting mm-hmm. about Governor Justice is that he's a Republican who became a Democrat to run for governor.
And so he's certainly familiar with the Republican Party, with their philosophies, with a lot of people who are in the legislature who are from that party.
Do you see any similarities, Dr. Beller, in Governor Justice and governors of the past? Perhaps Gaston Caperton?
Well, yeah, you know, when Gaston Caperton was elected, he was from the insurance industry. And he'd never held public office before he came into this brand new. He walked into a huge deficit, which I think we're experiencing
almost
now.
Right.
And what he did was to surround himself with a lot of people that had expertise and could help to advise him. And I think we see some of that with this governor. He certainly put Nick Casey in charge as the chief. And, you know, Mr. Casey has a longstanding background.
Former Democratic Party chair.
And also, you know, in working other campaigns. But Nick Casey's background isn't just, I think, as a Democrat, I would consider him more of an expert in conciliation, trying to bring people together. And so I'm hopeful for this governor. We certainly all need him to succeed.
Yeah, but Mary Beth, Gaston Caperton was involved in Democratic politics for decades, so he was not new to politics.
And his wife had been in a house before he ran.
But it's interesting that both Caperton and Al Justice faced a deficit of more than $400 million. Mm-hmm. And what did Caperton do? He immediately asked for $400 million in taxes, but let me tell you the difference. When he asked for it, there were only four Republicans in the state Senate. Yeah. Now there are 22, and they dominate both houses. Right. So what will happen when the governor asks for almost $500 million in taxes?
The other thing that has changed, I think, is political culture. You know, we now have just under 30 delegates who have signed the Grover Norquist Pledge.
Mm-hmm, pledge to not raise any taxes.
Exactly. And while the Republican leadership has enough of a majority that they can override that group now, they still hold a significant presence. We've been in an era, I think, for at least a decade now, in which the idea of raising taxes is really considered to be bad form. And so not just for the Republicans, but for Democrats, I think all of them are really hard pressed. The writing's on the wall. We have to have revenue. It's just how to make those very tough decisions.
But it sort of makes us nostalgic for the old days in the 80s, in which you had committee chair, three or four, that knew exactly what was going on, and they'd run over to the Marriott and they'd make a deal, and things would be done. Things would be accomplished.
Yes.
You didn't have this division and almost refusal to talk to each other or deal with each other.
There was a lot of criticism over those
things,
though, Bob Kiss and Earl Ray Tomlin making deals behind the scenes and then bringing them to the floor and they're already decided. But here we're seeing the exact opposite.
Well, you know, I think there are several things going on here. You know, number one, those people from the old guard had years of experience before they became committee chairs, right? Mm-hmm. And so they had a lot of budgetary expertise before they rose in rank. Now we have people who are fairly new and are progressing quite rapidly. Not only that, you have to remember, you know, the Republican Party only gained leadership positions just a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not in the leadership, then you really don't have major roles in making budgetary decisions. And you certainly don't set agendas in terms of legislative committees. So not only is a lot of the membership new, but the leadership is brand new. This is a new responsibility, and things that are that complicated take years, I think, to really develop an expertise with.
Ashton, we almost need a new app to follow legislative politics this year because things have changed so much changing now.
They really have. Now, Senator Mike Hall, the Senate Finance Chairman, and President Carmichael this week, they're pushing this idea that we'll get not a budget bill, but a spending plan done by the 30-day mark. And then after 30 days, we can decide if we need any new revenues. Dr. Rupp, are they a little bit too hopeful here? What do you think?
My mother raised me to be an optimist, and I'm trying very hard, Ashton, to be that. But I'm just seeing so many complications. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid we will be studying and looking at this legislature until June. But again, let's see what they can come up with. But the very fact they came up with this idea shows that the old system isn't working and they really haven't found a new one.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Bellard, do you want to take a guess? Do you think we'll be here until June?
Well, we won't be here longer than June 30th.
Of course, new budget has to be in place on July 1.
Right. But past that, I think that what the Senate president wants is ambitious and it's hopeful. And I think part of his role as a leader is to try to engender some hopefulness and some energy, right, into his crew. That doesn't necessarily mean this could literally happen.
But you know, Ashton, one of the reasons Bill Cole did not win in a Republican year is because they couldn't fix the budget. They came back in a special session, even though it was the House that kind of slowed things down. It hurt him politically. And I think there's a mandate for the Republicans not to repeat last year.
Absolutely. I think people in this state understand the anxiousness that agencies went through last year.
Yes.
You know, you have to think about it. So much of our state is dependent upon services. agencies can't plan their budgets. They can't tell doctors that there will be Medicaid reimbursement flowing through when the agencies don't know what their budgets are going to be to hire those people.
Causes a lot of anxiety
through our
in the
medical
public.
Industry, through education, through all these service industries.
I'm sorry we're out of time, but Dr. Beller from Marshall University and Dr. Rupp from West Virginia Wesleyan College, thanks so much for being
thanks
here.
Thanks for having us.
Monday morning on the West Virginia Channel, we'll be bringing you live coverage of a public hearing in the House of Delegates. It will be beginning at 8:30 on House Bill 2506 to make changes to the public drinking water standards. Again, coverage begins at 8:30 Monday morning on the West Virginia Channel or streaming live on our website at wvpublic.org. This has been the Legislature Today. I'm Ashton Mara. We'll see you back here next week.
Support for the Legislature Today is provided by the following.
AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State. Online at aarp.org/WV. West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission, working to double the degrees produced annually to meet workforce demands and grow West Virginia's economy. Learn more at wvhepc.edu. The W. Page Pitt School of Journalism and Mass Communications at Marshall University, providing hands-on education in advertising, public relations, and journalism across all media platforms. From West Virginia Public Broadcasting.